Welcome to This Is Money Show, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lambert and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost. Here alongside Simon Nye is personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And on the agenda today, well, we pack our bags and go on holiday, though perhaps not to Spain or Portugal soon, as the travel industry hits back over a big rise in claims against firms. Could we be banned from our favourite destinations? But what if you really do get food poisoning one away? We have some good and bad news when it comes to rip-off charges, uninsured holidaymakers being taken for a ride by unscrupulous car hire companies, but no more pesky credit or debit card fees when we book up. Also today, can the Bank of England and borrowers breathe a collective sigh of relief after a surprise drop in inflation? Why are we so unproductive compared to our European counterparts? And as ITV gets a new in-demand boss, Doctor Who gets a new doctor, we ask, does it matter what gender they are? All that and plenty more coming up, but don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, millions of us will have to work for another year as the state pension is set to go up to 68 by 2039, 7 years earlier than planned.
In 1948, when the modern state pension was introduced, a 65-year-old could expect to live for a further 13 and a half years. By 2007, when further legislation was introduced to increase the state pension age, this had risen to around 21 years. And in 2037, it is expected to be nearly 25 years. As the Crillon Review makes clear, the increase in life expectancy are to be accelerated. And I want to make clear that even under the timetable for the rise that I'm announcing today, future pensioners can still expect to spend, on average, more than 22 years in receipt of the state pension. The approach I'm setting out today is the responsible and fair course of action. Failing to act now in light of compelling evidence of demographic pressures would be irresponsible and place an extremely unfair burden on younger generations.
Welcome Pension Secretary David Gawke there making the announcement. Well, the change affects everyone born between April the 6th, 1970 and April the 5th, 1978, or one in seven of today's workers. But on the other hand, it is set to save taxpayers an estimated £74 billion by 2046, or £400 a year per household. A very warm welcome, Rachel. A very warm welcome, Simon. Rachel, was this inevitable?
I mean, it's inevitable that it would have to have happened at some time. We are probably living longer than ever. The pension bill is increasing every year. The argument is that it's unsustainable to have people spending so many decades of their life out of work and claiming the state pension. So it's inevitable that that would happen at some time. We sort of thought, I think, that this was one of the things that would be kicked down the road because it's deeply unpopular and we have a government that lacks some of the clout to do deeply unpopular things at the moment. Recommendations were made and the government was supposed to respond, but it was a question of when they would and how. Yeah, we couldn't afford it. It wasn't going to go on forever.
Simon, should Mr. Crillon have gone a little bit further? If you take a look at average life expectancy, as Rachel was talking about there, currently it's 79.6 for men, 83.1 for women. But men born today now expected to 90, women to 93. That's a very, very, very long time to live off a state pension.
It is a long time. But then those people who are being born today and would live till 90 or 93, they're not going to get a state pension at 66. They're not, probably not going to get a state pension at 68 either.
Will they get one at all, do you think?
Well, not some people have their way. They probably won't get one until they're at least 70, maybe above 70. So I guess that they'd end up with just less than 20 years. But then you've got to bear in mind that the life expectancy of those people might be 90, but there's going to be a lot of those people who die before 90. And any shift in the state pension age is always going to be better for those people who are lucky enough to live a long and healthy life and then do enjoy many more years in retirement. But is the downside of that is that the people on the other side of the line who die before state pension age, or actually it's more if they die just after state pension age, so maybe they only get 2 or 3 years, they're going to lose out. And also there are statistics that show that an awful lot of people in an awful lot of places aren't going to be very healthy by the time they reach state pension age. In fact, long before state pension age, they're going to be struggling. And then there's the question of how do you deal with this whole issue of people who do difficult or manual work. And we talked about this before on the podcast, and I said about how I was in a pub and someone was talking about this to someone, and I overheard them saying, and he was clearly a manual worker, he was a labourer, and he said, there's no way I could work until I'm 66. He's like, I'll be lucky if I could work when I'm 60. So yeah, what do you do? I'm not affected by this change because I'm slightly too young, but I don't expect I'll get a state pension until I'm 70.
What you were talking about there about the people who can't physically work, it's a very fair point. We had the World Economic Forum speak a few months back saying about we're going to have jobs for people in their 80s and their 90s. But in reality, is that even possible? We're talking about the rise of the robots. So what I'm asking you, Rachel, is what can you do now? What should we be thinking of doing personally now? But also, are you on the side of perhaps Ros Altman here, who says pensions need to get smarter, because we're talking about the longevity, but actually it doesn't take into any account significant differences in life expectancy across the country?
So there's two things that we can do sort of as a society and as individuals. I think there's a lot to be said for what Ros Altman's saying, that there are ways of making the state pension more dynamic. Perhaps people who want to retire earlier could take it, but as a lower amount. But as individuals, you've just got to save, especially if you're younger. I would be worried about banking on the provisions that are available for the current lot being available when younger people retire later on. So you've just got to save, and the earlier you do it, the better, because it all compounds. It's gorgeous. The sooner you do it, the better.
All right, on to some better news now. And finally, a crackdown on rip-off credit and debit card fees. From January, firms have been banned from adding charges, some as high as 3% to our bills. Businesses, though, say that the surcharge is to cover the cost of processing a card payment. Consumer champion Sarah Benwell from Good Housekeeping says they were hugely inflated and is welcoming the news.
So we've all experienced this problem, right? You're booking a flight online, you find the best deal, you click checkout and you get to your basket and suddenly it's like, ooh, you're paying by debit or credit card. We're going to charge you £2 or £3 or even £5 for that. And if you're buying a flight that only cost you 30 or 40 quid in the first place, that's a huge percentage that's going on a card fee. And I think it upset quite a lot of people, because how else are you supposed to pay if not with a credit or debit card? It's not just flights. You know, it happens with food delivery companies. It also happens in shops, particularly if you've ever bought anything from a corner shop. You'll have noticed that if you want to pay by card, there's often a 50p charge. If you're only buying a packet of crisps, that means you're doubling the cost of your crisps. So some people will charge a percentage. Some people charge a flat fee. It's kind of been up to them how they charge. There's not been much regulation about what you're charged, and that's 473 million we spent on these card charges in 2010. So there was an EU directive which said, let's scrap them. The UK has decided to implement that, even gone a little bit further than the EU. So the EU was talking about credit card providers and debit card providers. The UK has decided to also implement this ban for PayPal, for Apple Pay, for Amex cards. So from now on, nobody's allowed to charge you for paying by card, which is great news.
It is great news, and I could never work this out as to why they're so varied.
Yeah, it's good. You're right, it was so annoying when you paid for a flight and they whacked on 20 quid because you're paying by a credit card. And it was charged often as a percentage of the value of whatever you were buying, which I don't think that's how retailers are charged necessarily. So yes, it is good for consumers, and it's about time. And it was an EU directive. The Treasury has been saying just how clever it was to have done this. And yes, they have gone a little bit further than the EU directive, but it was theirs initially.
Simon, what do you think of this?
I think that it can only be a good thing, to be honest. I think that people have long been upset with the idea of buying something and then being charged for paying for it. I think that the issue is that there is a cost for businesses.
Explain that a little bit more.
Well, there's these things called interchange fees. And it all relates to the cost that they are charged as a merchant by the card company. So there's MasterCard, there's Visa are the main players in this whole payment system. And when someone takes a payment on a card, they end up paying a small amount in costs. Now, that obviously eats into their margins. So this goes some way to explain why you might find a news agent that tells you you have to have a £10 minimum spend, or that you have to spend 50p, or you have to pay them 50p or 75p extra charge, because essentially they're being charged a chunk of the money that they're taking. And what they're selling you is probably quite a low margin good. If you think about the margins in retail, they're very, very thin. So even if you buy a small basket of shopping that costs you £4.70, they might only be making 47p. And if the card company charges them 50p. Now, the problem is this is a very opaque world. And I don't think consumers would have as much of an issue with it if they had a sign on the desk that said, you'll be charged 50p for using your card. This is how much we get charged. We get charged X percentage or whatever, so people could see it. Because often you go in and you get asked to pay this. You've got to pay £1 to use your card. It's like, I get it. I understand why you're doing this, but you're clearly not being charged £1 here. Now, bigger organisations, there's a great question going on here, because actually what people feel is that there's just been profiteering going on here. For example, the airlines were the classic one, the budget airlines, the credit card charges for paying. Got it going on with Just Eat. Just Eat shares fell substantially on the day that this news came out, because Just Eat, the company which organises takeaway deliveries, takes a card charge, and a sizable chunk of their revenues, I think it was 13%, I can't be sure on the absolute figure here, but I think it was that, comes from the card charges that they charge people. But the feeling amongst people is there's certainly huge businesses like the airlines, people sending you tickets, anything like that, anybody like that who's charging you this fee is doing a bit of profiteering, because they benefit from the economies of scale. And the great unfairness about the system has always been that actually your news agent is penalised more by these fees that they have to pay than the local supermarket, your Tesco's, your Sainsbury's of this world.
But wouldn't it have been more sensible, though, to... Because I imagine the argument now for businesses is going to be we're going to have to pass that on to consumers. Wouldn't it have been better to have an EU directive that said you only have to pay exactly the cost of whatever you're being charged as a business to process this card payment, and then all the other bits, the Just Eats and the profiteering that they get, that is banned. So then there is no justification now if they say they're going to pass it on to consumers.
The only problem with that is that people expect businesses to absorb the cost of paying into the cost of stuff already. And actually the suspicion is what they do is they absorb it into the cost of stuff already, and then they charge you an extra charge on top.
That is what they were supposed to have done. Rules came in 2012 that said that they could only charge what it cost them, and that didn't seem to help. So I think banning maybe is the only thing that was left over. But it seems to me part of a wider problem we have of we just live in la-la land about the way we bank and spend money. We've all got these lovely cards, and we pay for them, we think it's free, and we take money out of cash machines, and it doesn't cost us anything. We have current accounts, and most of the time that doesn't cost anything either. But all of this has charges, and it just, if you don't pay for it up front, then it kind of just oozes into other places. It's what we've seen with overdraft fees. It's what we've seen with, there's been some sort of contentions with MasterCard overcharging. As Simon says, there are these intermediaries that are involved in all of these payments, but we don't really know how it works. But a lot of companies making a lot of money out of it. But I think it's a lack of understanding about how this works that means we get ripped off in sort of little places. So we've got this constant whack-a-mole of regulators saying, no, you can't rip them off there, you can't rip them off there.
So what's the solution then, apart from whack-a-mole regulating?
I think...
Everybody pays up front, banking isn't free.
Yeah, I think it has to be transparency. I think people have to know how much stuff costs that they're using and pay for it if we don't want other people to have to pay for it for us.
All right then. Another rip-off when it comes to our holidays is still very much ongoing. Car hire firms. Now, an investigation by your sister paper has found holiday makers who haven't bought insurance have faced a plethora of rip-off charges for scratches, child car seats and petrol refills. Now, you've heard cases where some firms are charging up to £8,400 for damage to a family saloon in Europe. Simon, what's going on here?
Well, anybody who has regularly hired a car will know that there is a little bit of a lottery that goes on. When you're shown round the car, you're given a piece of paper, and you're meant to mark on there all the dents and all the dings and any mark on the car. Now, invariably, you arrive tired, hungry.
It's dark.
Late at night, early in the morning. The person from the car hire company may or may not walk you around and point out the scratches, or they may just hand you a piece of paper. I had it actually recently where we were in France. It was a Saturday. We arrived at the car hire place just before it was closing at lunchtime on a Saturday, And the guy gave me the keys and he told me where the car was, which was sort of down the road in a car park, because it was a car hire place at a train station. By the time I had collected said car and returned, there was no chance of me telling him about any scratches on the car, because he had shut up shop for the day and gone home for the weekend, kicking my wife and kids out onto to wait on the street outside for me. Which was fair enough. Okay. He was meant to be knocking off at one, and it was at least 10 to 1. So, but I'm not joking. It really was before 1 o'clock. But you get this scenario and you think, oh, are they going to sting me for this? So you've got the damage issue. Then you've got the scenario where if you do actually damage the car, are they going to charge you a fair bill for what it costs? And car hire companies are notorious for sending people these astronomical bills for absolutely minor damage. And if you ever get a car hire company that does that, tell them that you want an itemized quote from the garage, and then you can then use that itemized quote to then compare to the actual cost. Go speak to a garage yourself and find out what it is. You'll probably find that the car hire company is getting it done at a main dealer, so the costs are going to be inflated anyway, but you shouldn't be paying through the nose for that. And finally, there's the game of car hire, it can only be described at the desk where you arrive, having booked your car online for your supposedly cheap price. And then you discover all the other little insurances and add-ons that they want to charge you for. The savvy traveller can cut these substantially with something like a car hire insurance policy, covers you for the excess, buy one for a year, costs you about 40 or 50 quid, covers you for the whole year, rather than a tenner a day, as the car hire company might try to charge you. Or you could even take your own child seat on holiday. If they charge you a flat fee for a child seat, it's not too bad. Some of them charge you per day. I have seen companies wanting to charge £7 a day for a child car seat. Go on holiday for a week or 2 weeks, and that gets very expensive. Whereas your airline will take your child seat for free. Ryanair and EasyJet will take your child seat for free. You've just got to have your wits about you when dealing with a car hire company, which is astonishing, really, because most of the car hire companies that people deal with are huge multinational businesses. And basically, I struggle to think of any other environment where people encounter such huge multinational businesses and expect to be ripped off on such a regular scale.
I do recommend going to read this article, because you say go prepared, but honestly, how can you even think of some of these things that they charge you for? It says, do bring your own sat-nav. Hertz, according to Money Mail, is charging £204 to hire a satellite navigation system. You can buy one from Currys for just £86.99. It goes on bills that never were. So you can also use things like reducemyexcess.co.uk and icarhireinsurance.com. Rachel, what are these?
These are really good. I love this trick. So when you get to the desk and they say, would you like to buy something that means that if you, you know, have a little scratch or something, we don't overcharge you thousands of pounds and it will cost you just a few hundred, most people say yes. But you can buy that from a third party that will cover the cost of the excess if you end up having to use it. And that can cost, it's like 3, 4, 5 quid instead of what can be sometimes hundreds. So that's a real good one.
What are some of the tips? I'm thinking here, taking photos of the car at the time, is that recommended?
Yes, it is actually. And this is something that I would recommend to people hiring cars, hiring any object, or moving into a flat, unconnected but similar scenario, is in your pocket. It's highly likely that you have a highly powerful camera nowadays, which can also take videos. And it literally takes about 2 minutes to walk around a car and take photos of it. Or better still, walk around it with a video camera. You will have some evidence that there was no damage to the car. And do it when you hand the car back as well, just in case they try and charge you for some damage. To go back to the insurance policy thing, I've got one with a company called Insurance for Car Hire. I've done this for years and years and years. I take out an annual one because it tends to be cheaper rather than a short trip. But the trick is say, for example, you're hiring a car because you're going on holiday in Easter and you take out an annual one. Well, when it comes time to renew that, you probably aren't going on holiday straight away again. You might not be going on holiday till summer. So don't just automatically renew it. Wait until summer when you go away, take another annual policy out, and now your policy will last a year in advance until next July, and so on and so on. So you basically don't actually have to pay for these over a rolling 12-month period. You can get away with paying them for actually shorter periods during the 12 months. But I would like to say something about car hire, and I think that it's important to give credit where credit is due. I went on holiday to Mallorca, at the end of May in half
you
term.
You always go on holiday. Every story starts with I went on holiday, yes.
Sorry, I do apologise.
I'm feeling sad I haven't got any holidays booked. Yes, go.
I went on holiday. We hired a car with Alamo, the sort of best priced recognisable name. What I didn't want to do is go for a company like Gold Car, who I've used before, and were quite literally the worst company I've ever dealt with in my life.
Good to note.
Yes, exactly. It included a man who, when I asked him to tell me at least how the car seat went in, even though he said he couldn't fit the car seat, refused to even tell me that, refused to tell me why there was a bit dangling off it, not working. And then when I got a little bit grumpy, said, "Relax, you're on holiday."
That's the best
Which
line.
Is a great attitude to yeah. your children's safety, I thought.
Oh,
anyway,
no.
So I arrive at car hire desk in the airport, and they were amazing. They've basically adopted this completely bonkers policy of really good customer service.
No.
The lady in the airport was really helpful. Then she told me exactly where to go. I got there. A man came up. He introduced himself. His name was Jesus. So, you know, it's great. It's a good start if you call Jesus. Helped put the bags in the car. Spoke to the kids. How are you doing? Are you enjoying your holiday? Walked us around the car and everything. When we came back, a lady came up to us. "Can I help you? Do you need a trolley?" She went off and got a trolley for us. And I have an email here that I got when we got back. "Good morning. We would personally like to thank you for using Alamo / Enterprise / National. And we really hope you are completely satisfied with our service. Do not hesitate to contact us if you have any doubt or any question regarding your rental. Thanks a lot for trusting us. And we hope to see you soon."
Aww.
And you know what? It's one of the only times in my life I've got that kind of email from a company. And I thought, damn right, thank you very much. You were absolutely brilliant. So hats off to them.
Yeah. And you've mentioned them in this podcast now. Should point out, though, that most UK car hire firms adhere to a code of conduct set out by the British Vehicle Rental and Leasing Association. So if you do have an unresolved complaint, you can contact their dispute resolution service by emailing them. Citizens Advice can also help. There are no specific EU regulations, but if you do have a complaint about a car you hired while abroad in an EU country and you can't resolve it, try the UK European Consumers Centre. All of the details are on This Is Money. Welcome to the This Is Money show. Editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss here with me. Coming up, we'll be talking about inflation, productivity, and does it matter if the new doctor, who is a woman? But a little update, actually, Simon, to report to you. Do you remember on last podcast that we spoke about my little complaint with my bank that took a long time to get my replacement card to me? Well, it took 7 days.
To remind our listeners as to what was going on here, Georgie was having a bank card sent from her bank to a bank. They were just sending it to her branch
pretty
so
much.
She could pick it up.
Absolutely, because I wasn't where I normally am, i.e. home. I was spending the week somewhere else. So I asked them if they could send it to there. That's great. They sent me a letter to tell me it arrived to my home. Not so great. So I was without that card. They had my card for 2 whole days. It was wonderful for them. So I listened to what you said, Simon, about complaining, and I thought I'd keep you up to date because Lee Boyce, your consumer affairs editor, encourages this sort of behaviour. So I called them up and I just said, "I want compensation for this," feeling a bit, you know, ballsy. So they said, "Well, how much would you like?" I said, "Well, as much as you can give me. Why don't you go away and find out?" So they came back to me eventually and they said, "Well, what about £20? I said, "Well, no, I expect £20 per day." So they came back to me and said, "We'll give you £50. So I said, "Done." So there you go, £50 for doing nothing, which makes me just realise if everybody did that, then maybe they would actually pull their fingers out and not spend 7 days getting your card to you. They even tried to justify why Metro Bank could do it within the day, but then failed because they had no reason for it.
So I think that there's an interesting point here to make, which is there may be our listeners, certainly, and our readers are quite vocal about this, thinking, compensation culture. This is exactly the kind of thing that's bringing this country down. People thinking they can get money for nothing. And part of this conversation came about with me saying that I'd got Nationwide to give me some compensation as well because they messed me around with my bank card for months, actually. But I think the point to be made is the one that you just made there, which is actually you do need to ask for this money off the banks and building societies. And it's not a compensation culture thing. It's a, you need to make them do this to compensate you, to pay you back for this, because it penalises them in some way. Because unless they're penalised, they don't change their behaviour. So if customers keep fighting back and demanding 20 quid every time their bank completely stuffs things up, I mean properly stuffs things up, not just, you know, a little stuff up. But if people do keep doing that, then the banks will eventually change their behaviour and stop doing it.
So, I do have to offer a thanks, though, to HSBC, not for the compensation, but that's the best money-saving tip I've had. That 6-7 days easily saved me more than 50 quid, I have to say. Anyway, moving on, households in the Bank of England got a bit of welcome news this week. Prices at the pumps contributed to a surprise fall in inflation last month, the first dip since October. Here's Ray Newton-Smith, Chief Economist at the CBI.
More generally, what we're seeing is a slightly softer patch in inflation, but inflation is still very much here and still quite high for a lot of our households and businesses. So while it dropped from 2.9 to 2.6, over the year as a whole, we're still expecting to see inflation peaking at around 3% later this year. And that's a lot stronger than average pay for most households, which is growing at around 2%. So for households, it's feeling a bit tougher out there.
So, Simon, Rachel, time for our favourite game of guess when the interest rates will rise. Please no, please no. But I imagine, though, Simon, it does somewhat ease the pressure on the Bank of England to raise interest rates.
It eases it a little bit, yes. I think certainly if the inflation number had come in higher than it was the previous month, or even the same, then the pressure would have continued and intensified, certainly if that number had been above 3%. But it's still there. This inflation issue hasn't gone away. There are some economists who will suggest to you that actually the Bank of England might have been right when it said it would peak at about 2.9% and that it might be about to ebb away. And there are other economists who will tell you that those people are living in la-la land and that the fall in the pound is going to keep hitting us in the pocket. So it's difficult to know which side of the fence to sit on, but I think we're probably going to be looking at 2 to 3% inflation for a period of time to come.
So a little bit of a blip rather than a trend, it going down perhaps there, Rachel. What was it put down to? Price at the pumps?
It was prices at the pumps, exactly. Other thing, hobbies. I've never really understood what that is.
Knitting.
Hobbies was down, yeah. But essentially, most costs are still going up, which, depending on your view, may or may not be in some way attributed to Brexit and the fall in the pound. You can get experts to say either way, blip, or this is part of a trend and actually perhaps inflation is starting to go down or stabilise. I think that's just because no one really knows, because it's dependent on so many different variables. There's the impact of the pound on Brexit negotiations, which are volatile, I think it's fair to say. We don't know what happens with the oil price. That constantly surprises economists, and that has a huge impact as well. Bank of England totally divided on interest rates, and part of that is because we don't really know about inflation. What we do know though is that it hurts. Costs are going up and people are starting to notice it, and wages aren't going up, and that's going to start to be an increasing problem.
So what should we be doing to prepare ourselves? Here are some tips from financial advisor David Braithwaite.
What worries me about this is that we could be lulling ourselves into a false sense of security. People that are getting mortgages now think that this environment, especially if you're a first-time buyer, is kind of normal. What worries me is that rates, when they inevitably will start creeping up, they're going to get a bit of a shock in terms of their monthly payments, and their biggest payment normally is your mortgage. So that's the first thing, sort of worrying thing. The second thing is, from the saver's point of view, the trouble with inflation is it makes savers sometimes take more risk than what they should be doing. So people are seeking higher returns. So they're taking risks in things a lot of people don't understand. We've had clients recently that have rung me and said, what are we thinking about investing? One of them was a car park somewhere in Dubai, for example. Just strange investments, or wine, they get cold call. And people are more susceptible to scams, maybe, because they realise that the bank and the building society rates they're getting aren't returning a rate that's equal to inflation. So there's a risk in cash. If you leave your money in cash, in real terms, it's losing more money than what the price of the goods and services are that it can buy for you. So there's a risk there as well. But for the right people, and if you're prepared to take the right risk, maybe it's a good time to maybe risk some of your money. You need still to keep some in cash. and maybe look at paying off some debts, or you invest your money somewhere else into a stocks and shares ISA or something, if you can afford the risk and the length of time, and maybe just have a good shake-up of your finances. All these stories are great news in a way because people start talking about money again. It should be topical, it should be in the media, and people should be taking more of an interest in it when it comes to their own personal finances.
I definitely agree with that. We need to talk about money more. Rachel, you wrote an article about this because you were talking a little bit earlier there that no one really knows, right? Nobody knows. It's just you're the only one who seems to admit that. But you actually wrote an article, Crystal Ball Gazing with Your Finances. How, when things are so uncertain, can you plan your finances?
There's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of volatility. It is difficult to plan around that, but I think that there are some things that you can do. The most important of which is we need a buffer. It doesn't matter if things don't get worse, but I don't think you'd regret having a buffer then anyway. But if they do, it's a really good idea to have one.
The same buffer, like a pot of just ready cash.
Well, no,
I don't mean literally
but
cash.
I think for most people, it's not even about having cash, it's about not having debt.
Right.
So the more of that you can pay off, the better. It's very tempting to say spend less, but that is quite hard for most people. I think we sort of have an ongoing narrative about our general profligacy and indulgence and our shopping sprees, and we just all spend too much money. And that is true of some people. It's not true of others who actually do struggle and use debt to pay for everyday bills. However, there are ways to cut back that do not involve just spending less on holidays and sofas and shoes. Checking your mortgage, making sure that you're on a good deal. Checking your energy supply and making sure you're not being ripped off there. That could be worth about 400 quid probably. If you've got debts, making sure that you're paying for them in the cheapest way possible. Mm. Insurance, every little type of insurance that you have, making sure that you're on the best deal for that. Go through direct debits, make sure that you're not being ripped off anywhere that you've forgotten about. That's not painful cutbacks. That's things that feel quite good, actually.
Yeah. If your bank has taken 6 or 7 days to get your card, have you called them up to
demand 50 quid?
Exactly, exactly. All right, we're going to stick with interest rates games, though. Does anybody think it's going to rise, by the way? I said I wouldn't play it, but I can't resist. Interest rates going to rise before the end of the year?
One rise this year.
Rachel?
No.
No? Okay. Well, according to some economists, interest rates will remain at record lows and wages stagnant unless we can solve our productivity puzzle. Now, the latest ONS stats show UK workers hold the rather dubious distinction of being among the least productive within the world's advanced economies. The hourly output per worker slipped by 0.5% in the first 3 months of this year. So that means the average British worker has to work until Friday afternoon to produce what a German employee would produce in 4 days. Now, this is damaging both wage and GDP growth. Here's Ray Newton-Smith again.
I think one of the real challenges at the moment is so far private sector pay growth has been relatively subdued at 2%. The only real way of having sustainable increases in pay growth for the private sector is increasing productivity growth. And for that, we need to focus on the right infrastructure, the right education, the right skills, and importantly, having investment and innovation across the economy. So I think that's where the government needs to focus on.
So Simon, what is productivity? What is the problem? And what is the solution?
Well, there's an easy question to answer, isn't it? an easy question that's actually three questions. Productivity, how much you produce in a certain amount of time. So per hour or per day or per week or per month or per year.
But, so are we just lazy then?
Yes, basically, right. The reason why it takes us until Friday afternoon to produce what a German worker can produce
Facebook.
In 4 days is because the British worker spends all of Tuesday morning on Facebook. That's the exact problem.
Isn't it?
If only it were that simple. No. If only it were that simple. It's a puzzle. It's something that is referred to as the productivity puzzle. And the pieces of this puzzle involve workers themselves, but also more what their companies do in order to help them become more productive. Because if you think about it, you can only do so much work, or you can only work at a certain pace. But if you start introducing things into the mix that mean that it, by doing so much work or working at a certain pace, you're actually producing more, then that's what increases productivity. And there's been a problem with companies investing since the financial crisis. There's been this other conundrum of why companies aren't using low interest rates and cheap money to invest more in their business, because the idea of investing in your business is you invest a pound in your business, on the basis that you've got a business case that says you'll make £1.50 back. And then if you can make £1.50 back, then you can pay your workers a bit more money. And then it becomes a virtuous circle and everybody becomes more prosperous. But Andy Haldane gave a speech about this the other week, and he said that one of the reasons he thinks is because only 1% to 5% of British firms are using robots to take the productivity high road. That diffusion rather than innovation, I think, is the key. So what he's talking about is the clever, smart companies should start trying to kick some of their clever, smart stuff right the way down through the economy and make everything better for everyone.
I thought that that was the job of capitalism. I thought that the way it worked, according to the rule books, are that you have some companies that are more efficient, that do things better, then they get an edge, they do better, the other ones fall by the wayside. Shouldn't capitalism drive those changes so there are incentives for companies that are not doing as well as their larger competitors to try and do so? I'm not sure that I buy that argument. It is totally a puzzle, and it's been one we've been talking about for years now, and there's not really any foolproof solution that anyone has found. And so what we have, I think, is a lot of retrospective narratives, things that could possibly make sense. So we have things like, in the crisis, there weren't as many layoffs as there might have been, that the amount of work dried up, but companies were reluctant to let staff go. It could be that businesses were so stung in the crisis that they aren't willing to take on the type of debt that they need to invest in their companies now. It could be, yeah, this machinery stuff that just people, companies aren't investing in the same sorts of machinery that other countries are. There was Haldane also mentioned management processes, that it could be a problem there. So it could be the stuff that...
Management processes mean? That could be anything.
People aren't being managed properly. There's
a bad manager in this country.
Significant link between the quality of firms' management processes and practices and their productivity, says Haldane. So we can blame the managers, we can blame the workers, we can blame the culture, and we can blame the materials that companies use.
Do you want to know one of the things I blame?
Yep.
Low interest rates. And we all know who's in charge of that. Bank of England. Andy Haldane works for the Bank of England. I think there is an issue, and I think Rachel said, isn't this capitalism's job? But capitalism isn't working. And one of the reasons why capitalism isn't working is because we've got lots of zombie companies who would otherwise have gone out of business, but have essentially been saved by perennial super low interest rates. Maybe we have zombie households and the same thing. So you don't have the creative destruction that is needed for capitalism to work properly.
Too much
because the interference in the market is coming from low interest rates and cheap money. And that actually the thing that is meant to be helping drive the economy is hindering the economy. And also, I think with the management processes thing, that comes down to motivation and rewards. And I think that the characterization of the British workforce, whether it's right or wrong, is a workforce that is currently under-rewarded and expected to put in extra hours for nothing. I think maybe that's part of the problem as well.
Maybe the answer, Rachel, is more women at the top. The reason I mention that is because you probably read this week that ITV has a new boss. Well done them. They've bagged themselves one of the most in-demand chief execs in the UK. But that's not the reason it's gained so many column inches this week. Companies, they get new execs all the time, don't they? What matters to the press, that is, and perhaps to the public, is that the boss is a she and a mum indeed. And in a week in which another top job was also taken by a woman, Doctor Who, should we still be remarking on top jobs going to women? Does it make a difference, Rachel? Why are we so bothered about it? Does it celebrate it? Or is it just, should we just consider it normal?
Gosh, I wish it was normal and I wish we didn't have to talk about it. And that day will come, Georgie. But in the meantime, she's one of three FTSE 100 bosses. It is a bit of an elephant in the room to skirt over that. It would be lovely not to talk about it, but it is kind of interesting. It's a news story that she's a woman. I don't think that the story is, you know, her hairstyle or anything like that. But it does bring this debate back into the fore in a useful way, I think, that there are so few, that this is novel.
I'm just reading this on your sister publication. Very good article. You're right. It doesn't talk about shoes, doesn't talk about hairstyle. But what is interesting, though, it talks about the fact she went to a Catholic boarding school in the UK. She studied history and politics at the University of Kent, began training as a teacher, etc., etc., etc. I'm wondering, would we still get a four-page biography of any other CEO or any other job promotion to a man?
No, you wouldn't get so much detail. For example, if ITV had just hired a man as the boss, I don't think you would get an extended feature looking at them. I think that if you get a feature looking at the boss of a company, it will always go into those things. It will talk about their background, it will talk about where they went to school, it will talk about all these other things. But it is notable that it's a woman. And I raised this when we were talking about what we're going to talk about in the podcast this week and said, shall we talk about this or should we not?
Why are you not sure?
Well, because I think that there is... because I see regularly a backlash from people on when you get stories mentioning that she is a woman, that the new woman is a boss. It's like, oh, she's a woman. Yeah, so's half the population. Why are you even mentioning it? And I think the reason why it's mentioned is because, as Rachel said, it is exceptional. Okay, there are not that many women who are the heads of FTSE 100 companies, let alone being one of the most in-demand CEOs in the country. And I think that from my point of view, I'm the father of two girls. I would like my daughters to be able to achieve anything on a level pegging. I would like any woman in this world to be able to achieve anything on a level pegging. I think it's good because I think it shows as an example. Were I to open that newspaper page, show my kids that, I'd say, look, she's the new boss, because there is this cultural phenomenon where we think of the boss as a man. It's still more likely to be a man, the person right at the top, and it's an example to people. And the other question that comes in here when these stories get reported as well is that it will also always refer to someone, if they are, as a mum. So mum of two, mum of three, mum of four, I think, in this case. And that's something that's always very controversial with readers. This is the kind of thing that gets debated massively in the social media echo chamber. Now, should it be? Because what people will say there is, well, would it be mentioned in the headline if they were a father of three? And the answer to that is actually no, it wouldn't. But then again, it is not exceptional that you get the fathers of three rising to the top, where it is exceptional for the mum of three. And it's harder. It's much harder for the mum of three to get to the top. OK, we live in a society that is still very much shaped in a way that helps men get to the top and helps men achieve in a way that it does not help women achieve. So when a woman does achieve something like that, or a mum does achieve something like that, they have done it against the odds, so to speak. Whereas when a dad does it, it's not against the odds. So it's not worth mentioning in the headline. And so, but I always feel slightly uncomfortable about the kind of, you know, mum of three kind of headlines. Mm. But then I also think that it's celebrating it. But I think it's something that it's interesting to have a conversation about. What do you think about it?
Well, I would like to big up a fellow podcaster, Malcolm Gladwell's Revisionist History. If you've not listened to it, do. I'm getting the thumbs up from Rachel there. And in the first episode of the first series, he talks about a lady called Elizabeth Thompson and uses it to illustrate this idea of moral licensing, where one virtuous act is used to justify future less virtuous acts, should we put it this way. So in the late 19th century, this painting by a virtually unknown artist took the country by storm, took England by storm, and it was called The Roll Call. But after that brilliant first effort, the artist, Elizabeth Thompson, she all but disappeared, and he explores why. And in this particular case, he argues that by displaying this painting, this woman's painting, it gave the Royal Academy the justification to refuse her and other women admission to their ranks for another six decades, because they could just pat their back, they could point to this one exceptional case and say, look, we've done it before. And he also talks to the former Australian Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, who argues pretty much the same thing. But it certainly doesn't make it any easier or for women that come into companies like ITV. It simply gives the status quo, the justification to slam that door shut again, to say, look, to pat ourselves on the back. We've got an article in the Daily Mail that says we're doing loads of really good stuff. Look, a woman is in the top job, but actually it doesn't do that. And we know it's not doing that because we still have things like the gender pay gap. Whereas if we just take it as par for the course, it doesn't become an exceptional thing. It doesn't stand out, stand alone, and allow people to say, pat ourselves on the back for a job well done. The job is not done, and we know that. Oh, I've got on my soapbox now. The new Doctor Who, does it matter that it's a woman? Does it really? The fact that the show's still going after 55 years, I think, is an absolute miracle. I don't know, Rachel, back to you. What can be done here to solve this whole issue so that Simon doesn't have to worry every time he thinks about putting an article like this in his publication?
I think, one, it's good to talk about it. I think this is great. I think it's not just about women, I don't think. It's about men as well. I would rather see it that, new boss of ITV, father of three, I think it should be respected and acknowledged that men have that role as well, and those the same responsibilities that women do. To rebalance requires a rebalancing on both sides, the responsibilities of both sides, and a kind of social acceptance of the responsibilities of both sides. It's not just about empowering women, it's about seeing the role of men as well.
No, I think that's true, because I think that the workplace is still shaped as such in the UK, and people's minds are shaped as such that what happens is families have children, generally in their 30s nowadays, and the woman goes on maternity leave and then looks after the kids, and she might come back to work full-time and the kid goes into full-time childcare, or she might come back to work part-time. But in people's minds, the cultural thing is not that the dad takes the paternity leave and then the dad comes back to work part-time, and that actually there is, I still think that there is across society, a scenario where it's expected, it's the norm for a mother to come back after maternity leave and say, I would like to work part-time now. And it does hamper their careers and it hampers their earnings. There's plenty of research that shows that. But I think that if a man does that, it will hamper their career and hamper their earnings by more, in fact, than it would for the woman, because it's seen as abnormal. Oh, that bloke, he's just shirking. He's taking time off to look after the kids. And I think that the problem there is, to go back to what we're talking about with productivity, this is particularly true, ironically, in the industries that spend vast sums of money educating their workers. So, the city law firms are the classic example. The cost of training your staff is hugely front-loaded, okay? Because you get these people in, graduates, and then you have to spend loads of money training them up, and they work very, very, very hard. They work all hours and everything. And they bring in money for the company, but the time when they really start to bring in money for the company is when they become partners and things like that. But they work very, very, very hard. And then what happens is you get a whole slice of them who are women who go off and have children. And then when they come back, it is very rare for a city law firm to let people work less than 4 days a week. And a lot of them say you can't possibly do the job in less than five. And then the women come back and then they work for the law firms, and then they still get worked all hours. They try to stick to their hours, but then they get looked down on by their colleagues. And what happens is there is a huge rate of attrition where people drop out of these law firms. And they take their skill set and they go off and work for another company. They go work in-house, or they go work for a smaller firm of solicitors or things like that. So there's a brain drain going on there, which actually is not in the city law firm's best interests at all. Because actually it's in their best interests to try and make those staff as happy as possible and keep them for as long as possible, because they earn them lots of money and they've spent a lot of money on training them up. And you can draw this comparison across industries throughout the UK where this happens, and actually realistically it would be much better to be more accommodating and try and keep those highly talented, highly motivated workers, who, I tell you what, there aren't many mums who come back and work 3 days a week who waste the morning looking at Facebook. They work very, very hard. It would be much better to keep them in the workforce, because then we would find that we were more productive, we were producing more, and we might all be able to pay ourselves a bit more money.
Maybe. Editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. We'll be back next week. Do hope you can join us then. In the meantime, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? Tell your friends and family and join in the conversation.